the UCR Podcast.
Fans of hard rock and heavy metal, we have a couple of good ones for you today. A double feature here on the podcast, you might call it. First up, former Megadeth guitarist Chris Poland talks with us about his early days in the band and also his new Nuclear Messiah project. If you haven't heard about this, the Nuclear Messiah album is called Black Flame, and that came out on Friday. You can find it everywhere that you get your music. We premiered a track from the album this past week, a great cover of Uriah Heep's Look at Yourself, featuring, check out this lineup, Sebastian Bach on vocals, Uriah Heep's Mick Box playing the guitar solo, Bob Daisley on the bass, Carmine Appice on the drums, and Derek Sherinian on the keys. That's just a window into the Black Flame album by Nuclear Messiah, which features a ton of special guests, including legends like Rick Wakeman of Yes and Journey's Jonathan Cain, a total of 6 different members of Megadeth, including Chris. And I think it's about 36 different folks total that play and sing on the album. It's a good listen that I think you'll enjoy. And Chris describes himself during today's conversation as a bit of a one or two trick pony. Well, I think we like his tricks. I will link to our article and the music in the description for today's episode so you can hear it. And our other conversation features Gary Holt of Slayer and Exodus. Gary stopped by to discuss the new Exodus album, Goliath, and we got into a lot of other topics as well. Slayer, of course, plus his experience performing with Slayer at Back to the Beginning, the tribute to Ozzy Osbourne, and he tells us about his love of pop music because, of course, when we're not doing our normal thing as music fans who work in the music business, guess what? We all like to listen to different things outside of that box. And thanks to DX Ferris, who had some thoughts on that and a few other things that he wanted to know more about from Gary. It's like Ferris is here with me on this episode. And don't miss Ferris's recent audiobook version of his Slayer book, 34 hours worth of hardcore Slayer knowledge. You're not going to get it anywhere else. Slayerbook.bandcamp.com is one place that you can grab that. Gary also gets into his early years with Kirk Hammett, what he learned from Kirk, how bands like Led Zeppelin helped to inspire how Exodus works on music today, and Gary tells us why we will hopefully be hearing new music from Exodus for a long time. Exodus Attack is the place where you can find information on the latest Exodus album and all things Exodus. It was such a pleasure speaking with both Gary Holt and Chris Poland today on the podcast. It's Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you being here for the UCR podcast. Do not forget that with everything you're reading at UCR or listening to here, you can get a further soundtrack to go along with all of it. Store.ultimateclassicrock.com is our musical paradise featuring all sorts of albums, books, t-shirts, DVDs, you name it, it's there. Use my discount code WARDLAW15 and get 15% off your order. Also, make sure you're checking out all the cool contests that we keep putting up at the website. We had passes this past week to go see the new Iron Maiden documentary and a sneak preview for you all. This week, I'm going to have your chance to win copies of the newly expanded edition of One of These Nights by the Eagles. But right now, let's get to today's interviews. We're going to start with our conversation with Chris Poland. Enjoy it. Well, this Black Flame album is so good. Kind of, I want to start there. Tell me how this conceptual idea that links all this material, how did that come together?
It was Brian Pereira came up with the idea, and he got together with John Lappin, and they, you know, had a meeting of the minds, and this is what happened. You know, it's like they pick and choose who played on what song. They picked the covers, which I thought were amazing covers to do. I think we're talking about a Sebastian Bach's cover today, right?
We are, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I had a chance to go to Las Vegas when he recorded that, and I just couldn't make it, and I wish I did. But when I heard it, it was already like the most progressive song on the record, but man, his vocal on that is like, it is so him. Like, it just makes that song, man. It's a great song, too. Uriah Heep's song, really good song.
How did you get wrapped into this to begin with? Let's start there.
Yeah, Brian called me up and said, hey, man, I want to do this, and I want you to be the, you know, the axis on every song. And, you know, I want it to be kind of like Chris Poland and Friends. And, you know, I didn't know, you know, I didn't want to call it a Chris Poland record because it's really not. It's like, it's an everybody record. So we became Nuclear Messiah. I just couldn't believe, like, when I heard Arthur Brown do Ride the Sky, that vocal, that's when I knew that this record was like really going to be off the charts, man. And it just kept getting better. Every time I heard another mix, I heard the Thor mix. Then I heard Electric Burn. I was just like, come on, man. It just, every track is so good. It's just crazy.
How did you kind of find your place in all of this? Was that, how easy was that for you to kind of find your place where you kind of fit into all of this in a way that, you know, made it make sense for you artistically?
You know what, man? I'm pretty much just a one or two trick pony. You know what I mean? I have my thing that I do. And when I do like a project like this, or any, even an own project, when it comes time for me to do a solo, if I'm playing parts, I'm just playing the parts, but I have my way of doing it. But, you know, I just kind of listen to it and I get an idea of where I think I would go, even if it's not the original solo style or whatever of the original song. And I just go with my gut instinct, and it's usually the first or second take, and it's, you know, just off the cuff.
I think for being a one or two trick pony, I think we've seen just with the Kings of Thrash shows alone, people have an appreciation for your tricks.
Oh, man. You know what? I get lucky a lot, man. I get really lucky. I was lucky a lot on the first two Megadeth records doing solos. They just came together. You know, it's all just kind of, it's kind of like the Jeff Beck I read somewhere where he said, whatever happens, happens. If it's great, everybody goes, oh, that's great. And if I blow it, I blow it, you know? And that's kind of how I go about doing it. And, you know, I just get lucky a lot.
As a music fan, what do you kind of recall about the moment where Uriah Heep lands on your radar?
Oh, I was like, I just was so surprised with all the covers. And it was just, that was the hardest song for me on the record, to tell you the truth. I had done an extended solo on it, but they went with Mick Box's solo because it was just so good. But I love the moment that sets that outro solo up. Everything on a record is like a little bit of magic happens on every song. And that's what makes records. This is the kind of record you can play over and over again, you know, and then go back to it a couple months later and play it over and over again, you know, again. So, because it has magic. So it's like, it's a really good record. And it had a lot against it. I mean, to have 37 guys and to get them together and have them all give 110%, which everybody did. I mean, it's really miraculous, man, that it came out this good, man.
You've got a lot of folks like Sebastian on this record. And what I've always loved about Sebastian is, when I was just talking about, you know, you being a music fan, Sebastian is 300% a music fan. And what you were saying about his vocal, he's like 300% all in on everything that he does. And I think that's why he is who he is, because, like, man, he was on a Triumph tribute record. He's done a few different things in recent years, but man, it's like, you can really, he doesn't just say, yeah, man, that's cool, I'll do it. He is like stoked about the fact that he gets to, oh man, I can't wait to sing that Uriah Heep song. That's going to be awesome. And you hear that in his performance.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Especially when his harmonies come in the second verse, chorus area. Oh my God. I was just like, you gotta be kidding me, man. He was singing when he was 20 years old again, man.
Yeah. I like too that about three quarters of the way through the song, I like how it just drops down to like the like drums and guitar. It's kind of cool. It gives the song, like, as epic and big as that song is, the way it drops down like that kind of gives it like this kind of casual kind of feel.
It comes down. It gets you in a moment, you know, where you're like, what's going to happen next? And then that huge outro guitar solo happens. It's just a knockout punch, man.
I'm glad you said that about the 36 folks that are on this record, because that's one aspect. And I know that Cleopatra kind of does this kind of thing, but it really is impressive how well this whole record hangs together, because 36 musicians, if you have five musicians is a lot of cats to herd. 36 is a lot of cats to herd.
And that was Derek Hughes and Jürgen Engler, they're mixing. They mixed all this together and made it cohesive, and it all has a thread going through it. So it's a record. It's not like a bunch of songs thrown together.
Yeah. What are some of your other kind of favorite moments on this record?
Oh, well, Electric Burn. I just love Adler's drumming on that song. It's just, come on, man. Oh, my God. The Pat Travers song. I really like that song, man. And I had no idea it was going to come out like that. It's like the keyboard part. It's just so killer, man. And of course, Ride the Sky, that song, I love Arthur Brown's performance. I love everybody's performance on that. I love the intro to Dice and Thunder. It is so
Yeah.
cool. It's just like there's so much going on this record, man.
How far along were these songs at the point that you're like playing on them? Like,
Oh, sometimes they were just skeletons, and
wow.
like the solo I did to on Electric Burn didn't have a lot of backing stuff on it. So at the time, I thought my reverb was good on my guitar, and then when I heard it later, because there was so much else happening, it seemed like there was too much reverb on the solo, but they did something to it and brought it forward, so they fixed it. But yeah, sometimes it would be just kind of bare bones. And then sometimes it would be almost completely done, you know?
I think that's kind of the process of making records in general, but was there kind of a moment where you kind of like learned the art of doing that? Because I think that like the first time you're doing that as a musician, it can be kind of hard to be like, say, one of the first guys to play on something, you know, if it's just kind of, as you say, skeletal.
Yeah, no, it's not hard. It's just you have to make a decision, you know? You have to decide on tone. You have to decide if the feel's right, you know, and it only happened once or twice,
Yeah.
and I actually got to redo two solos on this record, which usually doesn't happen. When you turn something in, then it's in. So
Sure.
these guys gave me, you know, a lot of leeway, which is cool.
Yeah, that's cool. But where do you think you kind of just, you know, m musically in your career, where do you think you kind of got the art for like approaching the recording process in the right way like that so that you didn't get hung up and in the weeds on stuff?
I just, like I said, I just go with my first instinct on anything, you know.
But that happened early on. Like, how did you get that?
Oh, probably playing with records when I was a kid.
Huh.
You know, just constantly jamming with, you know, records, and eventually, you know, I remember my first recording session. It was with a band called the New Yorkers, a fusion band that me and Gar were in. And you can tell that I am like, this is my first recording studio, you know, session. And I was totally like lost. And then eventually I got a little four track recorder, and that's where I learned how to let it happen, you know, like just let your instincts happen when you're doing something. And eventually I got it where I just when somebody sends me a track and they say, would you do a solo on this? I hear it, and then I just let I'll hear the ideas coming in my head of how I want to phrase to that solo. And then I'll get a couple phrases, and anything else that happens is just the way I play, like my one two trick pony thing. But it's the phrasing that makes it different. It makes my solos different, even though they're samey, some, you know, same tone and whatnot. But it's the phrasing that I'm looking for. And that's what I work on a lot now is my phrasing. Even if I, you know, I tend to play fast licks a lot, but I really want to work on my phrasing from now till, you know, till I'm not here anymore.
Where do you think that kind of sound and phrasing, kind of your style, you know, where do you think that kind of came from back in
Oh,
the day?
everything back in the day, Leslie West, you know, theme from Imaginary Western, all the Cream stuff, Hendrix, you know, the Red House on the Greatest Hits, the studio Red House version. Then I started listening to Jethro Tull. That's where I got all the rock stuff that I like, especially Led Zeppelin. Oh my God. Led Zeppelin I was like the first song, Good Times, Bad Times, the outro solo. That's basically my blueprint of what I think a good solo is. And then on Zeppelin III, the guitar solo, and Since I've Been Loving You. Oh my God. When the first time I heard that, I was like, I never even set out to learn it. And that's something I did, was I just stole the feeling that I got from these solos, like how it melt, you know, the way I felt when I heard it. That's how I would try and do something if I was doing it. You know, I just wanted to, like copying a style, I guess, not a solo. to per se, you know.
It's quite a melting pot, though, that you had access to. I think it almost seems kind of trivial to people that might hear a conversation like this today with everything they have access to on streaming and YouTube and all that kind of stuff. But just you, like a stack of records, and maybe there's a Zeppelin record and maybe there's a Jethro Tull record. You mentioned Mountain, you mentioned Hendrix. There's a lot of different things going on just with those four bands and artists, you know, that like can take you, any one of those four things could take you in a lot of different directions.
Oh yeah. Especially Zeppelin. I mean, every record's different, but then I heard Jeff Beck Truth.
Oh yeah.
And when I heard the solo to Rock My Plimsoll, I learned that solo. I set out to learn it. And then it was Jeff Beck every morning while I'm showering to go to school on a record player in the basement, loud. Then it was the Orange record with Bob Tench singing. And those were my go-to records. I was like, I'm sure my family was like, do you have any other records you want to play? But then somebody, I think I bought it, which was strange because I didn't have a job as a kid. I had to mow lawns to get any money. And I bought a record called The Guitars That Destroyed the World. And it has this cool, the reason I bought it was because the album cover was so cool. It's like that Keep on Truckin' art from the 70s.
Yeah, that's a great record.
It was these giant guitars, like, just crushing houses, and people are, little cartoon people are running. Anyway, the last song on the B-side was John McLaughlin's Dance of Maya. And the first time I heard it, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. What is this shite? You know, I was just like, I hated it so much that I listened to it over and over again because I was like, they couldn't have meant this. They didn't mean to do this. They didn't set out to do this, right? And I would listen to it and listen to it. And finally, one day I listened to it and I got it. And then that was it. I was like this, you know. It was like, my friends would be like, have you heard the new Kiss record? I'd be like, no. I'd play them, you know, Birds of Fire, the song. And they'd be like, what the dude, what is this crap? So everybody, like, music, they never talked to me about music after that.
You know, you mentioned playing with the New Yorkers. And I think that a lot of people, but also hearing that you were hearing stuff like John McLaughlin, like, it all starts to, like, make sense. But I think there's a lot of people that just, playing fusion music, that can be overwhelming for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. Just, you know, so how did you get wrapped in with that?
I just loved that. I really got into Weather Report, and I really loved Wayne Shorter. I couldn't do one of his solos, but I could emulate his idea, you know, his, what he's thinking about, you know, the, where he's going. I just kind of try and emulate it. I loved Solenoel. I especially loved Jan Hammer. And that's what I did. I just, if I could learn it, I would. If I couldn't, I would just get the feel of it, you know. Michael Brecker, Tony Williams' Lifetime with Alan Holdsworth was like, that's tattooed in my, you know, up here, man. It's just, and after you listen to that stuff long enough, Jaco Pastorius, all this stuff, you listen to it, and then at the same time, you're still listening to rock and heavy blues stuff. And like, there's a record that I heard when it first came out. It's Doyle Bramhall's Welcome.
Mm.
When it first came out, I was like, oh, it's okay. For a while, like 2 months ago, that's all I heard every day. I fell in love with that record, man. And I was just like, I was on a Doyle Bramhall freaking mission, man. I watched his show at the Great Wall of China like 3 times. I was just like, and that happens to me. I listen to somebody and I'm like, oh, I got to absorb that, you know. Same thing happened when I heard Mike Landau play at the Big Potato back when he was doing the wet dry wet rig. I was sitting at the corner of the bar watching him do his set, and it was otherworldly, man. It was like, that's when I realized I didn't even have guitar tone, and that I might even be a guitar owner and not a player. And I set out to get just better tone. And I've been on that kick forever. I mean, that's what I do all the time.
I think all players, though, are kind of doing that. They're all kind of like battling against that imposter syndrome. I think that's just for creative people and humans in general. You all run up against that at some point, one point or another.
Yeah, and then there's the, you know, I tried to get in with to the whole modeling, you know, guitar rig things.
Sure.
And I just couldn't go there. You know, I tried. The best one is the Fractal FM3. That is probably the best sounding of all of them. And I got to use one at a thing called Guitars Under the Stars. That's I think it's Eugene, Oregon, somewhere up there.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Anyway, I can't remember his name. I'm so bad. But he brought his rig to me during the morning and showed me how to use it. And he brought these two Headrush cabinets. I got to, you know, I did my thing, but then I got to sit in with a band to do Red House. And it sounded so good. I've used a lot of different modelers, and that one I could just tell if that's all I could use, I could play that for the rest of my life, man. It was Benny Appice was playing drums on that song. I love his feel, man.
Oh, dude, he's so good.
Yeah. Now his playing on the record is just, he's
crazy.
Amazing. Also, I want to mention the brothers from Canada. I'm so bad.
The drummers.
Yeah. His snare sound on Mad Men sounds like a freaking anvil. I wonder if they sampled an anvil, because it sounds so killer, man. He's got great feel too, man. Everybody, I can't even, you know, it doesn't, you pick a song and it's like, yeah, could it be any better? I don't think so.
It's a fun milestone that you've got six former members of Megadeth on this record.
Exactly. I know. I was talking with Ellison last night. We had to go do voiceovers for an animated movie that Cleopatra's releasing. And we were talking about the project. He didn't even know what it was. He was in Frankfurt, Germany when he recorded it.
That's awesome. What do you kind of appreciate about the legacy of Megadeth based on what you're seeing, you know, as you've done some of these Kings of Thrash shows? Because the set lists are unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. And upon having to relearn that stuff, like when we did the recording at the Whiskey, I had to try and relearn the solo in Good Morning. And it's just not possible, man. And it just got me to really realize Mustaine's, his writing. Like there's certain, like on the first record, he'll put a note or a chord in a certain spot. And for the life of me, man, I'm just like, why did he do that? Because it's fucking genius. But I would never think to do that. And so I'm starting to I want to think like that. I mean, it's like he does things that make his stuff special, man. His writing is special.
What else has kind of come back to you doing those shows and playing that material as far as, because you guys were just doing the work then. So it's an interesting 20,000 foot view to have a look at the material the way you have been, you know, now with everything you've been playing with Kings of Thrash.
To be totally honest with you, I started to feel vibed out because there was a lot of bad times when I was in that band.
I started
to have that haunting, you know, that feeling, you know, because it brought back a lot of memories. And it was just like, I would push that back and, you know, because this is fun, you know, playing with the Kings of Thrash. So, but it arrived. And I remember the day I started feeling that and I was like, that's bullshit, man. You're talking 40 years ago. Let it go.
It's hard to do that. I get that. You know, to that end, Peace Sells obviously has been called, you know, one of the most important albums of the time. A lot of people put it right there with Master of Puppets and Rain and Blood. When do you kind of start to perhaps realize that you've been part of an album that really hit the mark in that way with fans?
Well, sadly, I had headphones on and I was and it was a good turntable. And I listened to Peace Sells and then I listened to Master of Puppets. And I never listened to Peace Sells again after that for at least a decade.
Wow.
And then when I did listen to it, I realized that it's not how it sounds. It's what's there, you know, musically. And then when he did the whole remix remastering thing, that's when I was like, yeah, this record's unlike any other record. Both of them, the first record too. I mean, it's just I wouldn't even call it metal. It's like progressive, like anger. You know, it's like, it's just really good, man. And it's like, you got to hand it to Mustaine, man. He's like a great songwriter.
That album really seems like the one that lit the fuse. Like the touring goes global. That had to be just overwhelming.
Yeah, it was. And the thing was, is we did like at least three tours that I remember playing that record live. When we got back off tour on the third tour, we came, went right into the studio. So, you know, we had momentum going into the studio, and that's why that record sounds like it does, man. It was like, we just got done playing it for like 6 weeks, you know. Luckily we got Randy Burns, because he figured out how to record, how to get us to tape, you know. And I remember Scott Menzies, he was our, you know, he was our guy that took care of us. And yeah, in the studio I go, what do you think, Scott? He goes, I don't even know who this band is.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Like, if we look at the first record, I just want to get your memories of, you joined Megadeth. Like, what are kind of your memories of the early days of being in the band? I know that it was complicated, but I'm just thinking of like the times when you guys are like first jamming, like those early moments and stuff like that.
I was in the band 2 weeks before that record was recorded. So I knew maybe two rhythm parts, you know. And then I didn't have many, so I think I had one solo. And then a guy from Relativity Records, Kurt Caltera, he got in Dave's ear and he said, dude, you got to let Chris do way more solos on this record. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have had, you know, that those solos. Yeah, and he was such a great guy. He brought, we were at the Moody Blues Studios in Malibu.
Sure.
And it's not an easy place to access. You need an off-road vehicle to get there. Anyway, he brought a Sundowner amp to the sessions, which was an amp that Holdsworth had just started endorsing. And he goes, Chris, you got to try this. And I'm thinking to myself, this guy is so cool. He's telling Dave to let me do solos, and then he's bringing me an amp to do it with. I was like, yeah, I've been, like I said, man, I'm just lucky. I was lucky that Jay Jones managed the New Yorkers and somehow met Mustaine and started managing him. And when Dave needed a drummer, Jay Jones said, Gar. And then Gar told me, dude, you got to join this band. It's fun. It's complicated. It's going to be good. You'll like it. And I saw him live at the Waters Club, and I got in. I had been playing with Gar my whole life. I just had to be in a band with Gar. I didn't care what happened.
He's an underrated drummer, man.
Oh, his whole vibe and feel on that record. You know, for Gar, there is no one. Gar plays over the one a lot, and just that's what makes it happen. It's exciting.
Last thing here, you've done so much throughout your career. How'd you connect with the Umphreys McGee guys? Because I love that stuff.
Oh, we did some shows with them. We opened for them somewhere a couple times. And then we had a show in Chicago, and they said, man, let's do a jam. And so we jammed at this club. I don't think it was Andy's. It was something else. So it was a rock club, but a really nice club, man. Anyway, my mom was at that show, and we did like a, I think it had to be a 30-minute jam, because the drummers were changing, you know, drummers in the middle of a song just so another drummer could, you know, have a moment. And I asked my mom what she thought, and she goes, that was very long, Chris.
Amazing.
But anyway, we really had fun. So the guys in Umphreys McGee said, hey, man, let's get together and make a record. And it'll just be, you know, we'll make it up there and record it. So we did the first record at my studio. I recorded it with my stuff, and we did it live, and it is what it is. It's not as good as sounding as the second record, but the performances are great, and so are the songs. And that's how we got together.
That's cool.
It was a lot of fun, man. Those guys are super talented, man.
Well, dude, thank you for the time. It's good to talk a little bit of music with you. We went kind of all over the place, including fusion. So it's been a good day, man. Yeah,
before we go, I want to mention that Randy Burns has produced the latest Ohm record, and it's in the mix process right now. We recorded it at Lukather's studio called The Steakhouse.
Oh, which cool.
The board made for EMI London in 1970. And it's a magic console, man. And it's coming out on M Theory Audio, and it should be out pretty soon because the mixes are almost done. So I just wanted to plug that record.
Well, this was a lot of fun, man. I appreciate you taking some time. So I'll let you get back to things, but thank you. Thank you always.
Matt, have a great day, man.
Former Megadeth guitarist Chris Poland, do not miss the new album Black Flame from his latest project, Nuclear Messiah. And boy, sounds like he has some great stuff coming up, doesn't it? Okay, I promised you a double feature today. So here's our conversation with Gary Holt of Slayer and Exodus. This is Ultimate Classic Rock. I spoke with Tom back in October of 2024, and Tom was already stoked about what you guys had coming together as far as a new record. And obviously a lot happened in the few months that followed that interview. We find out in January of 2025 that Steve's out, Rob's back in. How did that kind of affect the course of where things were headed with this new record?
As far as affecting the songs, you know, like I write riffs and I'm going to write them no matter what's going on, you know, and the same goes for Lee. And, when we went into the studio for this album, we had like maybe 4 or 5 songs done. You know, we ended up recording 80% of the follow-up is done. And it's the most collaborative album we've ever done. Like, you know, Lee wrote almost half the music on this thing. And, but as we were tracking vocals, it became abundantly clear that Rob had a lot more ability to do a lot of different things than what he excels at, you know, historically, which is, you know, just raging aggro thrash. And he delivers like everything from just southern swamp metal on Promise You This to like, you know, ultimate high range vocal lines like in Summon of the God Unknown and everything in between. And it was remarkable. You know, I didn't know, you know, I mean, I knew he could do more than we'd ever asked him, because he does on the Generation Kill records, you know, he sings quite a bit. But, you know, because of the way we record, you know, we go in and we write the whole process through. We've rented homes and built studios in them and just lived the process like bands did in the 70s, you know, and Deep Purple go to Lake Geneva. Persona Non Grata, we went to Lake Almanor. And on this album, we didn't build a studio, but we rented a house and we lived the process. So when we're not in the studio, you know, we get done for the day, we go back, fire up the barbecue, and then we continue to play guitar. And Tom's got an electronic kit sitting there. And so we're constantly creating. And, you know, that's how you can go in with so few songs, but ideas are solid, and then come out with so much material. And working that way allowed us to, like, pivot when we saw these other layers to Rob, which is awesome.
Yeah, that had to be a pretty interesting thing when you started doing that, like just going away to, you know, get a house and live together and write and perhaps, you know, record, maybe do it all in the place. Like in your book, you talk about Exhibit B, The Human Condition, how you guys rent a house in wine country. I love the anecdote that basically you assure the owner, like you let him know, like, here's what we're going to do. We're not going to destroy the house. But like, I just think that obviously, we know from like how Led Zeppelin and other bands did albums back in the day where they would go and record in a castle or whatever. Being in a non-traditional environment like that contributes so much to the process, and also being together, right?
Yeah, totally. And that's how a lot of my favorite bands recorded. You know, they'd gather and assemble with no songs done at all. Queen, you know, they'd go and hold up in some, you know, villa or some chateau, and they just start working together, and that works for Exodus. But we enjoy each other's company, and that's half the battle. You have to like want to spend all that extra time, you know, apart from being on tour, which you're stuck on a bus together. And we've found that's the best process for Exodus. We did that on Tempo the Damned. You know, we lived in a warehouse and wrote, although we had most of the songs done. And it was really on Persona that we started going in and not caring how many songs were finished. You know, we would work this process like Exhibit B, but we still had most of the songs done because we would do the drums in a proper studio and then we would hole up somewhere else. But we realized that by limiting the drum tracking to like the first week means we can't recreate anything new. And so we leave the drums up, mic'd the entire process, and I'm able to like going, I got a new one, get behind the kit. You know, in the past, that song's save it for the future because the drums are gone. And Tom also can go back and revisit his own performances just like we can, which it was never fair that, you know, he'd like, man, I wish I could replay that fill. I could do it better, but my drums are turned down and there's no putting them back up. Whereas this guitar players could go in any day and just redo a solo, you know?
And how did you guys kind of start doing that as far as like going, okay, we're going to leave the drums up. Where did that come from?
The last album, you know, Persona Non Grata, which we recorded at Tom's house in Lake Elmenor. And he's got a big like workshop garage. It's huge, you know, big steel thing. But the previous owner, it had some kind of like editing studio built into it. So part of it was finished with sheetrock walls and all that. And we had his drums up in the garage. So he was able to like continue to like track. And like songs on Persona, like Fires of Division, I finished at the end of the process, you know, and he, you know, that would not have been possible in the old way of doing things. And like on the new album, I tracked Hostess Humani Generis with no drums. I finished it at the end and I went in and tracked all the finished guitars with a click. And then Tom learned the song and went in because I was like, all right, I got to lay this down. And why bother with a scratch track? I'm just going to finish the guitars. And Tom can go do the drums later. But the fact that the drums are sitting there, if we were able to do that, or that song wouldn't have been used.
Yeah, and I think that's like the classic thing, like save it for the next album. But I'm often curious, like, and I talk to a lot of folks that I feel like save it for the next album is kind of a myth, along with things like we'll fix it in the mix. You know, it's just like I think that for a lot of people, they're so creative that either they are the type of person, I don't know if you're this type of person, where it's like they will go back to that thing for the next album, or they are just well on to the next thing and they never, you know, think about that thing until they come across it years later if they do, you know?
I'm the king of well on to the next thing. Like,
yeah.
Because, you know, I like have an idea and like, you know, I'll write a really good riff and Tom will have to be the one who goes, what about that riff? And I got like 20 new ones that are better. And he goes, no, you need to go back and revisit it. And I have like hundreds in my phone, you know, if not a thousand. And I'll go back and I'll like, you know, some of them are like years and years old and I'll listen to that's really good. I mean, Tempo the Damned, The War Is My Shepherd, I wrote 80% of that song I wrote in 1987, exactly as it is. The only thing is I double timed the tempo. Good riff is a good riff. Goliath, I wrote everything but the middle harmony section I wrote in 1999 when I was spun out of my brain on meth, which we would think you'd write like a fast song, not the slowest thing. And every album since Sobriety came, I try to finish that song. And I just never could because maybe I can't detach myself from the era I wrote it, but I knew it was fucking heavy. And Tom and I always just called it creepy. And every album I'd try to finish creepy. And I could never do it. But I always gave it the college try. And on this album, I sat down and within an hour, I finished it. And I couldn't believe it. It was just organic, natural flow happened. I sent it to Tom. He's like, oh, my God, you did it. And it's one of my favorite songs. But yeah, you know, like sometimes, you know, it takes a decade plus.
That's pretty cool, man, because it's like, you know, yeah, it's I think it's we that's another thing we hear is that every song has its time. And that's like that sounds cliche when you say it, but it's just like there's so many examples that, you know, bear that out to be true. And that's got to be a good feeling to finally have that song in its place. But it's also just such a bizarre, I think it just kind of speaks to the bizarre nature of creating and making music and making albums is that there's if you're making music, I think, in the right way, there's no real logic to it. It's leaving your mind open for things to happen however they happen. And, okay, so maybe you have this song that, you know, you've had around since 99 that should have been done, you know, many, many years ago, but who cares? It hasn't been done for many years. Now it is,
time.
You know?
It spoke to me, you know, the riff lord said, you know, this is the era for this song. And it's like probably my favorite song on the album, that and The Changing Me. And you know, while we were working on, and Lee wrote that one and him and Rob wrote the lyrics. And while I'd be in the studio working with Tom on a song, Lee, you know, who lived closer to the rental house. So he stayed at home. He'd be working on his home studio on ideas. And we just, it was all hands on deck, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, everybody, Jack, all of us. we just lived the process, and we were on tour a day after it ended, you know, like we really grinded hard, you know, and our goal was to finish the follow-up at the same time because we had so much insane material. And I mean, the stuff we put aside is not cast-offs. It's, I have anxiety attacks still about which songs I chose. But you
see,
know,
I like
our,
that.
Our goal, because we're not getting any younger, was to have the follow-up ready so that we could like continue to like get these albums out when maybe age catches up to us, you know, and shrink down the time in between records. And so, you know, we're 80% there. So technically we only need two more, but Lee and I'll probably end up having much more than that. But you know, there's worse problems to have than too many like insane songs.
Yeah, I was going to say, people, when they tackle something like this, where they're going, okay, let's do two albums, they have kind of an interesting method on how it like separates. So how did the material between these quote unquote two records kind of separate out in this case?
It was hard, you know, like I still, like I said, I still have anxiety, you know, like, you know, some of my favorite stuff is on the next record. Half my best solos, I think, are on the next record. Like, damn, that one's really good. There's just, you know, I wrote, like, for instance, I wrote two epics, you know, Summon of the God Unknown and the one on the next record. So, you know, right away, we're going to put one aside and use one. You know, Summon has so many, like, layers and subtlety, you know, for a song as heavy as that. The other one is just an 8-minute hammer strike to the head. It's fucking ugly. It's so sick. I mean, it's just bludgeoning. And there's some of the catchiest stuff, you know, also on the next album, just lyrically, just killer, you know. But I wanted Lee's hard work super recognized on this album. So, you know, I took some of my songs and all right, we're going to push those aside, you know, for the sake of the betterment of the album and the band. And I think that's why the album's so diverse sounding, because, you know, there's a strong input from everybody else.
There's a lot of things on this new record that seem like that, Gary, they would have been fun to map out from a guitar perspective. You mentioned Promise You This, and I love that instrumental intro that unfolds over a period of about a minute. How do you feel like you were challenging yourself as a player and creatively as you approached what you were doing with this record?
That's one of the, probably the first song I finished. We don't do anything other than just jam. We're going to write riffs, we're going to jam, and we obey no structures or rules that are put upon us by other people, you know. And Promise You This, it's like, I always say, it's like if Discharge and Blackfoot had a love child, you know. It's like, it's got this like British hardcore punk meets southern metal sludge, you know. Even the way the riffs are played, you know, there's a like a, almost a slur to it that adds to this like swampiness, and I love it, you know. Violence Works, you know, for the, like, Tom, originally it was just a drum intro, and I actually questioned his disco beat there at the beginning. Like, he goes, no way, we're leaving it. So when Jack was doing bass, I said, come in with the little bottle, little funk thing. And then I added the little scratchy guitar, and like, and we were so happy, and we were like laughing, and we're like, for the first 10 seconds or whatever, people are going to think Exodus has lost their fucking minds. Exodus Faith No More, you know, like Exodus is like gone funk, and then the riff comes in and, you know, it's just all makes sense. But, you know, we'll try anything, you know, why limit yourself? You know, if it makes us happy, we're going to do it.
Yeah. Tom, when I spoke to him, called kind of your process, he called it jam camp. And I kind of like that. He's like, we just need to get in a room and yeah. You know, but I think you guys have kind of put down breadcrumbs that what you just described as far as like the funk and that kind of stuff. It's not incredibly surprising for the band that, you know, was not afraid to, for instance, you know, lay down a cover of like, we're going to cover, you know, Metallica's doing Garage Days, we're going to do Lowrider by War. Like, we all have our things that we like. And I think people know you guys are music fans. So I think that anything that they pick out that's kind of like Easter eggs on this record, songs, whatever it is, they're not going to be too surprised if they've been following what you guys do, because I think a lot of folks do know that you guys
are surprised. We've shown ourselves many times, you know, and Tom and I, you know, we grew up in the hood, you know, like, and so 70s funk is a huge part of our life, just as well as 70s hard rock, you know, and So that influence is always there, you know, and we're more than happy to like lay it out there.
It seems like one of the things that would obviously be pretty easy to do would be Exodus by Numbers at this point, but you guys definitely don't do that. How do you keep yourself out of that box? Because I think if some people even start thinking about that, then they get hung up on it. It seems like the best way is just like not to even think about the legacy.
I mean, I think the craziest, most insane part that I still like find like I'm still like, wow, this is nuts, is we're a band of guys in the 60s who are at the creative peak.
Yeah,
not totally normal, you know, but I think that's because Exodus carries the biggest chip on our shoulder than anybody in metal. I mean, we fucking feel so slighted and we're paranoid and we're but we also have shot ourselves in the foot repeatedly in the past, you know, self-inflicted wounds galore. And so, you know, we're making up for lost time due to our own like dysfunction. I mean, in the song Dirtiest of the Dozen, Tom wrote those lyrics and he had the line, with a gang of super heavy destruction absolute. And I said, you need to change that word to dysfunction. Cause you know, that's telling the whole story of the band's life from stealing equipment to death and everything else. And you got, you know, let's get a nod in there to our own dysfunction as well. And he agreed. And it's just my favorite line of the album. Cause you know, having lived it, it's like, yeah, that's us.
You talked about being these guys that are doing what you do now into your 60s. And, you know, when Exodus forms, like the Beatles weren't even 10 years in the rearview mirror. And that was something that a lot of us considered at that time to already be ancient history. Now you have bands like Exodus, Slayer, Metallica that have been going for 40 years plus. Like, what do you make of the fact that metal bands have been so enduring? Like, nobody could have necessarily expected that.
I mean, yeah, I certainly didn't. I think a lot of it has to do that we were fortunate to begin at a time when longevity was a thing, as long as you maintain some quality and had a fan base. Now it's so hard for a band to like to even fathom having a career that long. You know, attention spans are a lot shorter, harder to make money. You know, it's like there's a lot of obstacles in the way for younger bands, you know, unless you like just hit it right out the gate, you know. As far as like a slow build up in a career arc, it's really hard to do now. You're either going to hit it right away or you're just going to like pack it in at some point.
I think for fans, there was obviously a concern that, okay, Gary's going to do stuff with Slayer. Maybe that means we're not going to get any more Exodus. And thankfully, it's like there has been a world and worlds where it's like there's been Gary both in Exodus and in Slayer. Like, just generally, what do you think your time in Slayer has contributed to the material you've written with Exodus since 2013? What do you think all those experiences, what do you think you brought back with you?
Mostly what I brought back was Slayer, from time with Slayer, aside from like great memories and lifelong friends who were friends obviously beforehand. Mostly from a professionalism standpoint, musically, you know, I didn't write in Slayer, so you know,
sure,
and but I always do write, you know, my phone's full of riffs from just throwing it in front of an amp. You know, musically, I still write the same way I always have, but nothing's changed between 1983 and 2026 for me for the way I write a riff and song. It's exactly the same pattern, you know, that. Not patterns like as in predictability, but as far as like methods, you know, how I approach it. It's just always with a riff, you know, and I'll have like random song titles I like or subject matter. And I put them in the phone in a notes until I find a home for them.
And I appreciate how you speak to the fans at certain points in your memoir. One particular example addressing criticisms that you don't play Jeff's solos note for note, telling fans why you're not doing it that way. Basically, look, I can't be exactly that guy without remaking myself as a guitar player. Even then, I still can't completely be that guy. A lot of folks wouldn't necessarily be that honest and frank about it. So I appreciated seeing that. And I think a lot of fans probably appreciated you going into your methodology as far as how you schooled up to play those initial Slayer shows. Player to player, what did you come to appreciate about Jeff's particular approach as a guitarist, immersing yourself in the music the way you have?
His riffs, you know, it took me a while to kind of learn the way Jeff thought about writing a riff, you know, and that all you learn that as you're learning to play them. I would start learning a song and I'd get notes wrong because I'm sticking to like established structures of chord progressions and scales. And Jeff put no rules on his note selection, you know, and it equaled some of the most iconic riffs of all time because he was so outside the box on what a guitar player does. You know, me, I'm self-taught, but, you know, I'm pretty well schooled. And like, so I would learn a riff, but I'm like, all right, I'm sticking to some kind of like, you know, scale structure that makes sense to me. And then after a while, though, you start learning how he thought. You start kind of getting inside the riffs a little, and it became easier to learn subsequent songs of his, you know, as Carrie added more to the set.
Yeah, and no different to how we were talking about how Exodus does the thing of like getting in a room and, you know, jamming. There's these things that I think that are important. And I loved reading that, you know, when you were first starting to like kind of school up Slayer wise, like you had the albums in the car and you're just jamming the records. But, and I think that's kind of a, people do it different ways. Some of them, you know, they're playing along with the records. Some of them are, you know, writing it out, charting it out. But I do think that's kind of the best way to kind of just initially just absorb the music without any sort of distraction, so that you're just literally just hearing the songs no different than you would if you were hearing those albums for the first times as a fan. Because there's things that you come away with doing that in that way that you might miss if you were taking a more clinical approach.
Yeah, I mean, when I learn a Slayer song, the first thing I do is just listen to it for like a couple of weeks. Because until you know it like a fan knows it, it doesn't make any sense to try to learn the notes. You need to know where everything's coming. Then you learn how to play it. But, you know, if you know every time change and every, like, you know, dynamic, it makes it much easier than just jumping in and learning something that you don't have committed to memory yet.
Well, just one song on the Slayer side of things. They have these songs, obviously, like Seasons in the Abyss, for example, that have become legendary stone tablets of heavy metal for several generations now of music fans and musicians. If we look at that song, Seasons in the Abyss, what's interesting to you about how that song is put together?
Just the drama, you know, like Slayer went from just being pure, unadulterated thrash to like being able to put a song together with so many layers to it and so much subtlety and drama. It's like one of my favorite ones to play. It's awesome. I love it.
That's fantastic, man. Well, as we mentioned, you're a music fan. Revolver did a fun list at a certain point where you named off some of your favorite non-metal albums, and you are a big Madonna fan. Same here. What is it about Madonna for you And if you're headed to that proverbial desert island, what Madonna record would you take with you?
I would take True Blue. It's just fantastic.
Nice.
I love pop music. I always have, you know, and like, I loved Madonna when we were out on tour with Venom. I was singing at a bar and Cronus was looking at me like I'd lost my fucking mind. I just always love pop music. I still do. Like, you know, I love good pop, especially really good pop music. Like all I listen to these days is Adele. It's like, she's just
really,
because I love really high end piano playing. And some of her songs are like at the top upper echelon of, you know, piano playing. Like if I was a professional pianist and you got a job for touring with Adele, that's the dream job, because it's not like two note stuff. It's like complex, you know, things going on. And she's like the greatest singer of our generation. So you have two of my favorite things all in one. So, yeah, I don't, you know, it's like a mechanic who works on cars all day. You don't want to come home and work on a car. I play loud, distorted guitars all day. I don't necessarily want to come home and listen to loud, distorted guitars.
Well, you're also a big Prince fan, and he's one of those guys who could seemingly do anything. What perhaps is the most recent Prince rabbit hole you went down, and what do you love creatively about who Prince was as an artist, player, and songwriter?
He's just the greatest there ever was or ever will be. There was nothing he couldn't do. I mean, describing my love for Prince is like trying to describe why someone likes one flavor of ice cream better than another. It's just it's a love that I was a fan and I knew the material. And then I was lucky enough, myself and Rick Hunel were given tickets by management to see a one-off he did at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco. You know, this is at the peak of his powers and place holds, you know, 2,500 people. And we had seventh row center tickets, and it changed my life, changed everything. Like, I've never been so blown away in my life by what I'd seen. And changed everything. I've seen them many times, and just, you know, I own all the albums and several bootlegs, and it just means everything to me. He's just a genius. Was a genius, obviously.
I'm always jealous of San Francisco and the venues there. I mean, you mentioned the Warfield. Obviously, back in the day, there was the Stone. Like, there's just, like, I'm sure, man, there's just a laundry list of gigs that are just formative for you that you got to see there in the Bay Area.
Yeah, totally lucky. Lucky to be a part of it.
One of the things you got to do last year is you got the experience of being at Back to the Beginning and witnessing what ends up being the final showings for Ozzy and Black Sabbath. And man, what was that experience for you?
It was the greatest musical experience of my life, being a part of that. Yeah, that's the only way I can describe it. You're surrounded by, like, genuine legends of this metal and rock industry, and every ego was checked at the door. Everybody, you'd go down and to watch someone else play, and everybody's watching each other. And, like, I'd have to remind myself I do have to play and go sit down for a little bit. You know, you can't be on your feet for the next fucking 3 hours and be at your best. So, you know, but it was remarkable. And never, and seeing Ozzy and Sabbath for the final show, I'll never forget it. And none of us expected that he'd be gone so soon after, but I think in Ozzy's own way, he got to say his goodbyes to his public. And then he had, what was it, 17 days later, I think, he passed away, and he got to spend the remaining days with his family. You know, I can't think of a better way to go out.
I know you were hoping to get a chance to say hello. Did you get a moment with Ozzy?
No, I didn't. I didn't even ask. I'm sure if I probably, like, inquired, I probably could have gotten taken back to his compound, but it's like, I still view myself as a lucky fuck who's just even lucky to be there. So I don't push that kind of stuff, and then you see pictures of some of your friends who were there, and yeah, they're back there taking a picture with Ozzy, but I just didn't want to be that guy. You know, can I go get that picture with Ozzy? I mean, Slayer was scheduled years earlier to play a festival with Ozzy, and he got in the ATV accident and they canceled, and I carried my Black Sabbath Converse, you know, all across Europe just to have him sign it that day, and he wasn't there. It sucked, but I did wear them that day. I wore them once.
Dude, those are great shoes.
Yeah, I wore them once, the Masters of Reality ones, and it had, and all of us in Slayer signed them, and then I put them away.
Oh, that's fantastic, man. Well, last couple things. Your longtime pal Kirk wrote the foreword for your memoir. What was kind of your major takeaway sharing and learning the things you did with Kirk, from Kirk? Like, what sort of philosophies and parts of your approach do you think stick with you that came through him or from your time with him?
Well, I mean, I owe my entire career to Kirk because, you know, from the moment we actually met, we became immediate best friends. And he asked, do you want to play guitar? Want to learn to play guitar? And, showed me some chords and a couple of licks, and 6 months later, they handed me his guitar at practice and said, you want to play a song? And I played Judas Priest Grinder. And they said, you want to join? And I didn't even own an amp yet. it changed my life, and I owe it all to Kirk.
That's fantastic, man. Well, this new Exodus record, it's called Goliath, and I think it stands tall in that kind of way, man. Here's what we'll leave with. What do you still want to accomplish with Exodus? What is still on the bucket list?
What do I want to accomplish? Just to keep making great music and keep performing as long as I physically can. You know, like, I have no desire to quit. We still love doing what we do. We love each other's company. And we still have tons of, like, just upper echelon music in us. So we're not going anywhere.
Dude, I've been excited from the moment, you know, that you guys came back with some of those initial records, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, and, you know, Tempo of the Damned, Shovelheaded Kill Machine, on and on and on. So it's pretty inspiring and pretty great to see you guys still rolling. So, you know,
thank you,
congrats
so much
on this. All right, man. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.